Hello, and welcome to Pardes from Jerusalem, the podcast series from the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies in Jerusalem. I'm Larry Kluger, a Pardes alum. This week, I want to bring two things to your attention. The first is the offer of free tuition at Pardes this upcoming school year of 2009 through 2010. Details are on our website, pardes.org. Please check it out and tell people that you know about the offer as well. Free tuition is something not to be missed. Also, the summer program at Pardes, details are now announced and available on the website. I've also sent information about the Pardes summer program through the podcast system. It's a document that's available through your iTunes connection. The summer program is available in different lengths to suit everybody. A one-week executive seminar program is offered, plus the three-week summer program is offered in June, July, and August of this year. So look into it, check it out, and come to Pardes this summer. You'll have a tremendous time. This week, Rabbi David Levenkreutz discusses Vayakhel Pekudei. There's a handout for this podcast, which I'm sending as the next file, so be sure to print that out and use it to follow along if you can. Rabbi David Levenkreutz is a faculty member at Pardes and serves as the Pardes Director of Special Programs. And now, Rabbi David Levenkreutz.
Thank you, Larry. A few days ago, I overheard two students speaking about the upcoming ceremony of Birkat HaChama, the blessing of the sun. This is a Jewish religious ceremony that takes place only once every 28 years. And I was amazed at the level of knowledge that they had about it. Not only the halachic details, but the scientific background to it, the philosophic details. They even knew a number of midrashim that dealt with this issue. Given that their level was quite beginners, I went up to them and asked them where they knew this deep Talmudic knowledge of this rather unusual and not that well-known ceremony, and they looked at me and said, Wikipedia. The fact of the matter is that Wikipedia's dream has really come true, and that is we can go online and get all manner of knowledge, not only about Jewish subjects, but about general subjects as well. And I often wonder, is this really a good thing? It's clear that there are advantages. A knowledgeable person is able to speak to their doctor or their lawyer or their child's teacher with confidence. Having knowledge and being able to use it in profitable ways can improve society. Being able to build upon another's ideas can only make the world a better place. On the other hand, I, and I'm sure many other people, have some serious concerns about whether this proliferation and democratization of knowledge is indeed a good thing. On the most extreme level, one can go online and learn how to make a bomb or how to commit suicide. And in fact, it can be very, very dangerous that the knowledge is so out there. If all knowledge was available, it might mean that people have less incentive to invent new things. The fact that I'm able to patent something and keep the knowledge to myself in some cases is a spur to creativity. What about quality control? A person reads about a certain drug, goes to their doctor, but doesn't have the background, doesn't have the context to understand. More specifically, when it comes to Jewish religious knowledge, there's something very powerful in terms of identity. There are different religions, such as the Druze, where even the members of the religion don't know, have all the knowledge of that religion. There's something very, very powerful in terms of identity, of keeping knowledge to oneself. And certainly we know in our own tradition about Kabbalah, the Zohar, where traditionally one has to be over 40 in order to learn it. By the way, a very good way to deal with midlife crises that the tradition developed. But here the idea was this was knowledge that people were not yet ready for until a later date. And there's something very powerful about keeping it very, very special. And so with this in mind, it is interesting to look at the story in this week's parasha of Bezalel, where we know, or we have learned, that Bezalel was not only a wonderful artist, not only somebody who built the Mishkan with great precision, but, and you can follow along on your source sheet if you have it in front of you, in Shmot 35:34, we read, Ulehorot natan belibo, huva olia av, Ben Achisamach Lamate Dan. God also gave him Bezalel and Oholiab, son of Ahisamach of the tribe of Dan, the ability to teach. The Torah goes out of its way to say that not only was Bezalel a good artist, but Bezalel was also a wonderful teacher. He was somebody who was generous with his knowledge, who was willing to share what he knew with other people. And one can see that for a slave people, this must have been quite a luxury. A few weeks ago, they were in Egypt, and now suddenly they're talking of the aesthetic. This contrasts very, very strongly with the next text, which is in front of you, which is from Yoma, from the Gemara. The Gemara tells us in Yoma, this is actually the Mishnah, sorry, not the Gemara, the Mishnah. The Mishnah in Yoma chapter 3, Mishnah 11, tells us that at the time of the temple, there were certain families who had certain skills, but they kept the skills to themselves. They were like guilds. They guarded their knowledge, and the rabbis frowned upon it. We read that the house of Garmu, who were able to bake a thin and fragile showbread in a very, very good way, they knew the secret to not break the showbread. They did not teach any other people their baking skills. The house of Abtinas would not teach others how to make the incense. Higros, who was the son of the tribe of Levi, had a special finale that he would use in his singing. As a Levite, that was his job, but he would not teach it. And finally, Ben Kamtzar would not teach anyone his art of writing. He had something which was rather wonderful, and that is that he could take four pens at one time, put them between his fingers, and write the name of God, the Yud, and then the Hey, and then the Vav, and then the Hey, in one fell swoop. So all of these people had the most amazing skills, the showbread, the song, the incense, and the writing, and they wouldn't teach it, and the sages were not happy about this. Amrulahem Chachamim, this is in Yoma 38a, Amrulahem Chachamim, the sages said to them, Mara itim shelo lelamed, why did you not teach it? And the answer was, in our father's house, they knew that this house would be destroyed. We knew the Bet HaMikdash was going to be plundered, and perhaps an unworthy man would learn it, and then proceed to serve an idol with it. The people in the Beit HaMikdash were worried that one day when they weren't in control, other people would take this knowledge and use it in order to serve foreign gods. In other words, they were worried about the knowledge being misused. So the question then is it good to teach or is it not good to teach? If we live in a world in which all the information is out there, what value is there in still teaching and in still having a relationship between student and teacher? I think we'll be able to answer up the question of understanding both Bezalel and these houses who refuse to share their knowledge by understanding what is special about a teacher. If you look over the page, I've given a range of quotes from different parts of the Tanakh, from different parts of the Hebrew Bible that use the same root, hey, resh, hey, that is used about Bezalel. In Breishit 21:2, we read about it in its context of Vitahar. Sarah became pregnant and gave birth to Abraham's son in his old age. It's very, very interesting that in English too, we see these as connected. We speak of the conception of a baby, but we also speak of a conception of an idea. And so in some way, pregnancy, the act of giving birth, is in parallel to teaching. A teacher puts knowledge out there in a special way, but the student is the one who has to decide what to do with it. One of my students pointed out that in fact, becoming pregnant is a very, very sophisticated process. Anybody who's suffered from the effects of infertility certainly knows that it's not so easy often to become pregnant. The egg and the sperm have to meet at precisely the right place. And perhaps this gives us a hint of the importance of teaching. Teaching is not just the passing on of data. It's not just the question of taking what one generation taught and giving it to the other. There's a certain intimacy. There's a certain direction about it. And we see this emphasized three quotes down in Shmuel Aleph. The background of the story is that David is running from Saul, and Jonathan makes an agreement with him. He says, David, you go and hide, and I will come near to you, and I will bring a boy with me, and I will shoot arrows. If I shoot the arrows in a way, within his range, close to him, then you will know that it is safe for you to come out. But if I shoot the arrows far away, then you should know that it is not safe for you to come out. And indeed, we read in the story that Jonathan comes out, and Jonathan comes out with a na'ar katan, a young youth, a very interesting word. On the one hand, he's a youth, which implies teenagerhood, but he's a na'ar. And he says to him, Vayomer le'na'aro, and he said to his boy, Ratz, matzana et achetzim, go and find the arrows, asher anochi moreh, that I shoot. The word for teaching is connected to the word to shoot. What is shooting? When I shoot, I guide the arrow, but it can be affected by the wind, and ultimately I have no control over what it does. When I shoot, I try and aim to the mark. I try and get to what the teacher is saying. In this case, he shoots further than what the boy is able to go. He shoots further than where the boy is. And that's also the aim of a good teacher, something that no Wikipedia can ever do. And that is a good teacher knows how to push their student just the right amount, enough that they're able to have a feeling of achievement, but not so much that they're going to feel as if they have failed. In other words, teaching is an intimate act. It's an act which protects knowledge, because when I teach it and I share it in a certain way, I know that because of this relationship, the person understands the importance of the knowledge and is not going to misuse it. In this way, Bezalel was a good teacher. He didn't feel like the houses did in the time of the Second Temple, that they needed to hide their knowledge, because he knew that the knowledge would be protected by the relationship. We all know that even on the most practical level, sometimes you can read a mathematics book, you can see the proofs, you can work on it at home, you can ask a friend, and suddenly a skilled teacher will teach it, and you'll look at it and you'll say, oh my goodness, I now understand it. It just needed to be said to you by a person in a certain way. So good teaching not only safeguards knowledge and makes sure that its context and importance is understood, but is also effective in passing on knowledge in a way that the mere sharing of data is not. But there's something else going on in Shmuel Aleph, which I think emphasizes this even more. If we look when they start, it says that he is a na'ar katon, he's a young youth. One or two words later, he's referred to as lena'aro, as his youth. But finally, at the end of the little passage I gave you, the boy is called Na'ar Yonatan. On the one hand, in terms of David and Jonathan, this is the ultimate example of knowledge which is protected, knowledge that is guarded, knowledge like the houses in the time of the Second Temple. David and Jonathan have a code, only they have the knowledge, and in fact they're tricking people. But in terms of the relationship between Jonathan and this lad, the fact of the matter is that we see a relationship slowly growing. When one has a student, out of that relationship, those students learn how to pick up the arrows. Out of the relationships, they become your students, but it's your students not in the way they become our students. I speak as a teacher. They become our students not in a way that we control them or tell them what to do, but in a way that from the relationship, they develop and grow and become who they are. It's interesting that we call a wise person a Talmid Chacham, or the woman might be a Talmidat Chacham or Talmidat Chachama. Very, very often people think of a Talmid Chacham as being a wise student. In fact, it's not a wise student. A Talmid Chacham is a Talmid of a Chacham. It is the student of a wise person. We gain our wisdom. We gain our independence. We gain our insight. Our relationship with somebody who's older than us and wiser than us, that is how we learn. And that is why, in some very, very powerful way, if we go back to the previous Pasuk in Dvarim 33:4, Torah Tzivalanu Moshe, what really happened is it wasn't so much that Moses prescribed or Moses commanded the Torah, but if we go back to the pregnancy metaphor, Moses gave birth to the Torah in front of Am Yisrael. Moses, God was the ultimate teacher. God taught Moses the Torah, and Moses, as a good teacher, birthed it to his students. And so we see in a very powerful way that teachers are not going to be replaced by computer screens, that the type of teaching that Bezalel did, which involved a relationship, which involved guidance, which involved teaching people the importance of context, is not going to die. And if it were, we really would be in a position of the houses of the time of the Second Temple, where we would have to protect our knowledge in a very, very powerful way. It's interesting that the native peoples of Australia do not have a written down tradition, and a lot of their traditions have died. It's interesting to compare the Chinese calendar, which is the domain of just a few people, versus the book of Leviticus, which we're going to read next week, Vayikra, which is the most radical document. Why is it a radical document? It seems like a very ordinary, sometimes boring book. But the fact of the matter is that the Leviticus tells us the priestly rituals. For many, many ancient people, the only time you could learn priestly rituals was when you were a priest yourself. Leviticus is a democratization. Leviticus says to us, everybody can know what goes on with the priests. And so we see that our tradition has both examples. It's happy and wonderful to have the democratization of knowledge exemplified by Wikipedia. On the other hand, it still sees the value very, very much of not relying on it only, but of having teachers who can tell us what to do. There is a story of a man in a certain town who became a chassid. He had originally been an opposer of the Hasidic movement, but he became a chassid. And somebody said to him, how is it that you, such an opposer of the Hasidut, became a follower of the Hasidic way of life? And he said something very, very simple. He said, in my town, there was a chassid. He taught what he knew, and I took what I needed. Ladies and gentlemen, the ultimate aim of education, what Bezalel could do so well, he taught what he knew, and I took what I needed. He taught what he knew, he shared it with the students, he trusted his students to take the knowledge they needed, but he also taught in a very special way. He shot arrows that got their mark. They say that the difference between a rabbi and a rebbe is that when a rabbi speaks, everybody thinks that the rabbi has spoken to somebody else. When the rebbe speaks, everybody thinks the rebbe has spoken just to her or just to him. This is what teaching as shooting arrows really means. It means speaking in such a way that the student can hear and absorb. It means understanding the student, but ultimately trusting the student to take the knowledge and do with it what they will and what is right for them.
Thank you, Rabbi Levenkurs. Your comments on the podcast are always appreciated, so please send your emails to podcasts@pardesusa.org. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you on the next episode of Pardes from Jerusalem.